Please join me in welcoming our workshop leader and speaker today, Clancy I from the Pacific Group in Los Angeles.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here today. I'll tell you what's really sad in my life. I got up this morning, cold and raining in Los Angeles. I came to Portland to get a little sun. What does this mean, Lord? But I'm happy to see that so many folks have chosen to take one of their three sunny days a year to come to a inside affair. Glad to see Joe here, who we sent him up here as a missionary some years ago, and I thought maybe he'd been boiled and eaten by now. And Ron, who gives me a weekly report on how swimming pool sales are going in the Portland area and the depressions they bring. But I'm glad to be here today. The workshop, they asked me what I was going to name for a workshop, and I thought of phrases that Norm Alper used to talk about in his meetings when he talked, called seconds and inches. Because when I first came to AA, I knew about as much, when I've hung around AA a while, we all get the basic information that once upon a time there was a guy who got treated by Dr. Jung, and he came back and got this other guy and got him straightened out, and he called on Bill Wilson, and Bill Wilson then went out to Akron and called on Dr. Bob, and just one good thing after another. The program grew and exponentially, and it just became wonderful, and now here we are. And all of these things are kind of true, but they're not really true. I don't know any place in the world I've ever heard of where so many things had to just happen just exactly right. So easily, just a little bit off, and we wouldn't be here. We talk about this disease of alcoholism in the first place, and what's the big deal? We get sober, so what? But it's hard to realize that, there are a couple types of alcoholics. There are alcoholics who seem to have drinking problems. Something happens that really threatens their security. They can lose a job or a family, or somebody dies, and they quit, and they never drink again. And these same people are the same type of people who, when they became addicted to alcohol, which is a different kind of form a little bit, and they are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created, to medically withdraw people from alcohol addiction. Because, we talk about narcotic addiction, how difficult it is. Alcoholic addiction is much more lethal than drug addiction. When you can come off drugs, you're very, very sick for a while. You come off alcohol addiction and you sometimes die because you go to convulsions and smash your head and just terrible. And they go to the treatment centers, they medically withdraw them, show them the nature of their problem, and they quit, they never drink again. And there's a number of people like this. In fact, up in Seattle, there's a big big treatment facility called Chic Chadel. And they have a whole list of names of people who've taken their 30-day course and never drank again. And we kind of look at that starting, what am I doing wrong that it didn't happen to me? But then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink and have trouble, and something happens that really threatens their security. They lose a job or a family, or somebody dies, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And the same type of person comes out of treatment center sometimes with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. I see the problem. But sooner or later, they always drink again. And this is the type of alcoholic that has baffled civilization for at least 4,000 years of written history. And I'm sure whatever they had before that. People who have been exposed to all the reasons why they should not drink, but still must drink. And they've tried, at one time they thought they were possessed by devils and put them to death and flog them and put them in prisons and nut houses and send them away. And they've had all kinds of cures. When I was a young man, there was a thing called the Keeley Cure. That was the big before I was a young man, in the 20s, that was the big cure, where they gave you alcohol with drugs in it, made you sick. So you didn't want to drink anymore until you find a bar where they didn't put drugs in it, you know. And these are the people for whom there's never been a treatment in all of history. When I was born, there still was not a treatment for it. I didn't know, I didn't care, of course, but in 1930, which seems like a long time ago if you're young, but really it was not so very long ago for me. There was a family in New York who had a son who felt so sad, but he's about 35, and they're grooming him to take over their big business. There's a big depression going on, like worse than it is now, but they were doing well. And their son seemed to have a problem where he would get attacks of nerves. And when he had these attacks of nerves, that made him drink alcohol, and he'd drink a great deal. So if we could only beat this nervous thing. So they looked around, and they found the best doctor in the world and contacted him whether they could treat their son. Now, most people don't realize this, but the first one they contacted was Dr. Freud in Vienna. And Dr. Freud refused to take the case, which is the first break we ever got. We could be sitting here today drunk and saying, but I dreamt I was sober. So they went to his colleague, his ex-student, Dr. Jung, and most of us know that story. Family hired two attractive young men to escort their son to Switzerland, and Dr. Jung agreed to take his case, and he worked with them for a year, broke through those psychic barriers that was keeping him from comfort and his problems. And at the end of the year, he said, Roland, I think you so thoroughly have broken through now. I think you're all right. I don't think you have to worry anymore. Go back and live a good life. And on the way back, they stopped in Paris with some wealthy friends of the family, and they had a dinner in his honor. They toasted him to Roland. Roland had a little drink, and 3 days later he was face down in his own vomit again. They couldn't understand why. He didn't have any attack of nerves this time, just got drunk. So they took him back to Dr. Jung and said, Doctor, sorry, Roland didn't quite make it home. And Dr. Jung said, he can't come back in here, which sounded terrible. It was a lucky break for us, turned out. They said, why? He didn't mean any harm. He said, no, I realize now I misjudged his case. I misdiagnosed his case. I thought he had deep psychological problems that I could help him with. But I realize now he is what's known as a chronic alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for that condition in the world at any cost. Just think what that means. And of course, old Roland said, what does that mean, doctor? He says, it means, Roland, that you must keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live. Otherwise, you almost certainly will intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. And Roland said, is there no hope for recovery? And the doctor said, well, in my studying of the literature of these people, I have read a couple of cases where there's been some involuntary psychological reversion. They call it a spiritual experience or something. But he said, I've never seen one. He said, I would suggest that you have a better chance of being hit by lightning than by a spiritual experience. Now, this is kind of bad news. So Roland came home, and he didn't stop in Paris for any dinners this time. And on that ship, apparently he did something that we all have to do, although he didn't know we did it, and we sometimes don't know we're doing it. But he surrendered to the fact he was helpless. And he came back, and he'd been very active in church work. He was a nice guy. He was an elder in the Presbyterian Church, a vestryman, they called him. And but that hadn't helped. But there was a movement going on then called the Oxford Movement, which was in the full cry, by coincidence, just the right time to be in the, what it was. In 1908, a Pennsylvania Lutheran minister was worried about Christianity. He was kind of going to hell. And he thought, well, we should be like these first century Christians who who were willing to be crucified for their belief, were willing to do anything, to be tortured for their belief of God. So he started an organization called the First Century Christian Association, where people would be willing to do whatever necessary. Of course, it really didn't draw a lot of fans. But after the First World War, he went to England, tried to peddle it over there. And for some reason, the students at Oxford University were just swept away by it. Wonderful. That's what we want to do. It just became just so much so that they changed the name to the Oxford Group. And then he came back here in the 1920s with all this juice going for him, and the Oxford Group took off. What it turned out to be was how it worked was that groups of people would get together in people's homes and discuss spiritual values and how they could enhance their spiritual values. Kind of like an S only for spirituality. And this, Ed Roland had heard about this, and by this time in the 1931, it was big, big stuff. And since he thought, I'll go to the Oxford Group. And as he wrote later, a very touching thing, he said, I wanted to stay sober as long as I could, so that when I died drunk, my parents would have a pleasant memory of me. And that's kind of touching. And he went to the Oxford Group, and he got swept up in it, and he stayed sober. And his family was pleased, and he was pleased. And of course, they all thought it was due to the Oxford Group, but I suspect it was due to being surrendering on that ship more as much as anything. And he did so well that they started to give him responsibility for the company. And after a couple of years, he was doing so well, his family were so pleased. They said, Roland, you're really doing good. You've done so well. Why don't you go up to our summer home in Vermont, where we always used to go in the summertime. Go up and just relax and take a month off and 2 weeks a month. Just go up there and enjoy yourself. He said, that's a good idea. I feel good. And he went to Vermont. But the interesting thing is, if he had got there 2 weeks later, we wouldn't be here. Isn't that ironic? The second day he was there, some friend of his came in and said, gee, I'm so glad you're here. Our friend Ebby, who used to play with us when we were kids, he's a bad drunk. Maybe I know that you used to drink. Could you talk to him? He said, sure, I'll talk to him. So they brought him, and he tried to tell Ebby a little bit about the Oxford Group. Ebby didn't want to hear that. I don't want to hear that. Come on, Roland, for Christ's sake. And then a few days later, Ebby got arrested. He had run his car drunk in somebody's house, and he was on strict probation. And again, his friend came back and said, Ebby, I said, Roland, I hope you can help us. But Ebby's going to go to the penitentiary. And I've talked to my dad. My dad's the judge, but he won't listen to me. Maybe he'll listen to you because he knows you and knows your family. He's a good friend of your dad. Would you come down and talk since you're here? I said, okay. He went to the jail and court and said, Judge, you know me and know my father, and I understand Ebby's problem a little bit, and could you possibly think about releasing him in my custody and I'll take him back to New York and put him in the Oxford Group? And the judge said, I wouldn't do it for anyone else, but I know your father and I know you, but since you're here, take him out of Vermont. If he comes back here, he's going to the penitentiary. So away they went to New York. And he stuck him in the Oxford Group, and finally wound up in a mission on Lower Broadway, but going to the Oxford Group. And he didn't like it at first, but he got so he was feeling kind of good. He was staying sober, doing with all these people and talking good game, and he liked things for a while. And one of the concepts of the Oxford Group was that once you've been in it a while and had learned some of its lessons, you ensured your own recovery by sharing it with someone else. And one day Roland said, Ebby, it's time for you to share. And Ebby said, I don't want to share. It's bad enough being here, for God's sakes. He said, you want to go back to Vermont? He said, no, I think I'll share. She said, okay, now, you got to find someone to share with. And Ebby thought, he went through, what am I going to do? Find some stranger on the street and share with him? And he said, oh, I know. This other guy that I used to, my old pal from Vermont, who's really a bigger failure than I am in New York, living off his wife, can't hold a job, real mooch. I'll share with him. He won't even remember it the next day. So that won't be too bad. So he got a hold of this mooch named Bill Wilson. and made arrangements to come over. Of course, our book talks about it. Bill writes, he came to the door and he looked so well. He said, "Gee, Abby, you're looking good. How do you do it?" And Abby said, "I've got religion." And that kind of took the punch to the balloon. I listened to Abby talk. He had a little more detail. What did happen was like that. But then they went and sat down at the kitchen table, and Abby tried to share about the Oxford movement, and old Bill just kept drinking as fast as he could. "Gee, that's really wonderful, Abby. I hope you're happy." And that kind of irritated Abby. I mean, he hated to be outsmarted by a drunk. So one of the things that is not in our book but really is true, Abby came back 2 or 3 days later, and he had the Oxford group closer with him. "I want to talk to you, Mr. Wilson, about the spiritual values of our program." Which, of course, did for Bill what it would do for most of us. "Screw you, I don't want to hear this." But he agreed to come over and see Abby after a while. Maybe in a couple of weeks he'd come over and see him in his mission. So he started over one day to go to his mission, and he kind of got drunk on the way. It wasn't his fault. And he arrived at the mission, and Abby wasn't there, but he gave a short sermon anyway, just so the trip wouldn't be a total loss, and staggered on down the street, really in bad shape, and he wound up in the hospital, where he always went when he was in really bad shape, at Towns Hospital. And the doctor called up Mrs. Wilson and said, "Mrs. Wilson, I want to tell you something. Your husband's back in the hospital. And I really hesitate to tell you this, but this may be his last trip here. He can't survive many more of these. He's in bad shape, and he may be dying." And she was shocked, and she remembered that she had talked to Abby when he's over there. So she called Abby at the mission and said, "Would you please go see Bill? God, he's in bad shape." Abby said, "Sure." Took a couple guys off there and said, "You know, Bill, you got to find some kind of a higher power." "I don't want to hear that, for Christ's sake, I don't want to hear that." So they said, "Okay." They went home. And in the middle of the night, this poor, drunken, sick, hopeless, virtueless old fool woke up and apparently had one of the true spiritual experiences. As he wrote later, "It seems to me there was the room was full of light, and I could hear wind blowing. My God, I'm going crazy. I'm going crazy." And it darkened down again. And he talked to the doctor the next morning. He said, "Doctor, I hope I didn't have a psychotic breakdown." He said, "But God," he said, "I don't know what you had, Bill, but whatever you had, hang on to it, because you're looking different." He said, "Really?" And he cried out. He had cried out, "Oh, God, if you're there, show yourself to me." And the light came on. So he came out of the hospital. Now he starts going to the Oxford group. And you think, well, what's all the talk about Roland and Abby and all this? You know, that was necessary. He might have had it. He'd go to the hospital. The reason was this. And usually, among the very, very few people that seem to have these experiences, if they had them, they associated with religion and would get into church work. Bill somehow had it in his mind that this was associated with getting people to stop drinking. So he went to the Oxford group, and they didn't talk about stopping drinking, but it's certainly a good thing to do. And he did quite well. He joined in. He did quite well. And he began helping people. He'd find street drunks, take them to these Oxford group meetings. You know, the Oxford group members weren't thrilled. These were nice, prim society people gathering on a Sunday morning to discuss spiritual values. "I think you vomited on my shoe, sir." Lose a little bit. He'd take him home at night and give him a place to stay if he had no place to go. And he did this for several months. And one morning he got up after about 6 months, and he noticed the guy he'd brought home the night before had done what many other people had done he brought home, got up early and stole something to sell for a drink, this in case they took some stuff out of the kitchen. And he watched his wife putting on her sweater with the patch on the sleeve, this little society girl he'd married, who'd become prematurely gray and old with the life of with him. And he realized, he said to him, "Lois, my God, I thought I was doing something so grand and trying to help people. But I'll tell you, honey, I haven't worked all this time and you've been trying to support me, but I'm going to get a job. I'm going to stop doing all this. This is ridiculous. I'm going to stop doing this. I've been trying to help these people for 6 months and not one person has stayed sober. And I'll tell you something. Right there, you're in my life hung by a thread so thin it's almost impossible. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I was having lunch with her many years ago in Connecticut. And I asked her about that. I said, how did you ever think that great answer? She said, I don't know, it just seems so obvious. He said, not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. And, oh yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. You just go through life. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So he tried, and as a result of that, a couple weeks later, somebody offered him a job. Somebody heard that he's doing better. And you know the story, he went out, going to go out to Accra, and he's going to get the stock together for this big company, and he's going to become president. He's on his way. And they sent him out there and said, Bill, now don't blow it. Don't lose these proxies out there, because if you blow this one, you're done. So it's everything's on your shoulder now. So he took the train, got out to Accra, dreams of glory, and the whole deal blew up. Just blew up. And oh my God. He stood in the lobby of his hotel in Akron in May, one hot May morning, looked in his pocket. He had $10, a $10 bill. He could either pay his hotel room or take a train back to New York to go back to admit his failure where he'd never get another chance. And he was so depressed. And looked out of the corner of his eye. I stood in that hotel trying to recreate these feelings once because I'm kind of a romantic. And over there's a bar with a curved little sign over saying cocktails. And you heard the sound of music coming out and the clink of glasses. And he knew, as much as anyone else would know, if I had a couple drinks, I could think of an answer. And he started, and right there, boy, you and I were almost dead. And out of the corner of his eye, he saw some payphones over here. And he remembered he'd promised his friends to call somebody the Oxford Group before he drank. So we went over there, and I don't know if you've ever been to small town hotels, but I don't know if they still do it, but there's the phones, and up here, they always have a big sign with the various big churches with the ministers and their phone numbers. And he called the top one. He said, hi, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hound from New York, and I needed to find someone who was in the Oxford Group who was a drinker. And the man said, I don't understand what you're talking about. I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me. And then he called a couple of people who didn't answer. Then he called someone else who said, I don't know, I can't help you. Don't bother me. And I don't know about you, but I think I might have said, well, I did what I said I would. I did my best. Maybe just one little drink to tide me over. But he noticed at the bottom of the list was a funny name, minister, and a funny last name. So he called him up just to see what happened. He said, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hunt from New York. I'm looking for somebody in the Oxford Group. And I said, funny you should call. I have a parishioner who has a doctor who has a drinking problem. Let me see if I can get a hold of her, and maybe we can get a hold of him and you can talk to him. What a surprise. And so he stood in the phone booth while they made a series of phone calls back and forth. And, you know, it must have been tough for him, hot in that phone booth, don't know if anybody's going on, what the hell's going to happen. But finally the call came back, and it was this woman. She said, I called his wife, and unfortunately he's terribly inebriated today and needs to sleep on the floor so he can't talk to you. But we can get together tomorrow. And he said, well, all right. She said, and turned out she was the wife of the heir to the United States Rubber Company. She had lived in a big mansion. She lived now separated from him, so she lived in a gatehouse which was bigger than most mansions. She said, come out to my gatehouse. Here's how you take the bus or the streetcar to get out here. So on that morning, he went out there next day, and his doctor, his family bundled him in a car. He's still terribly hungover. On the way out there, he had a daughter and a son. And the son I was a pretty good friend with, and he died a couple years ago. His name was Young Bob. But he was 16 then. His father had him drive because the old man was too sick to drive. And all the way out there, he said, my dad kept saying, Ann, I'm so ashamed because today's Mother's Day and I'm in this condition. But I'll give him 10 minutes, 15 minutes for your sake. But God damn it, I'm not going to sit there and listen to any sermons. I'm just tired of all that. So they got there. And they chatted briefly, and Bill said, let's go to this room together and sit down. So they went in there, and they waited the 15 minutes for him to come out. They were in there 4 hours. And they came out, and this doctor had, he said, my God, Ann, that's the first man I ever knew that seems to know how I feel and why I drink. My God, Ann. And he said to Bill, could you possibly stay with us maybe a couple of weeks and you could help me work through some of these problems? And Bill thought, let's see now. I have no way to get home. Yes, I can stay a while. So he moved in with them, and they talked every day about the spiritual values. Went to Oxford group meetings together. Bob flourished. After a couple of weeks, Bob said, Bill, I'm going to ask you one more thing. This weekend is the American Medical Association convention in Atlantic City. I was there last year, and I was so drunk, they all ridiculed me, made fun of me. And I want to go this year and let them see me how I really am. Would you stay here with my wife and kids, and I'll be back Monday? I said, sure, Bob, that's great. And away he went on the train. Monday morning, phone rang, 7:30. Mrs. Smith answered. Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry. This is Dr. Bob's nurse. He came in town so drunk tonight that last night he carried him off the train. The station agent called me. I came down, took him off the floor. He's on the floor of his office now. I'm so sorry. I know he was trying so hard and you had such hopes, but I'm doing the best I can. Would you want to come down and get him? And once again, boy, our life, what a heartache that was. So they went down and got him and brought him home and put him to bed. And he goes, I'm so sorry, God. I'm so sorry, honey. Finally, Wednesday morning, he sat up at the start and said, God, what day is it? He says, it's Wednesday, Bob. Oh, my God, he said, I have to do a cancer surgery today. I can't hold a knife. I've got to do it. I'll lose my license. I'm on probation now. My God, what can I do? And they got him up and bathed him, clothed him, and his new friend Bill got him a couple of drinks to steady his hand. And away he went in his car to the hospital. So I'll be home by 1 o'clock. At 1 o'clock they waited for him. He didn't come. Didn't come at 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. I knew where the old son of a bitch was. He's drunk. At about 6 o'clock he sprung through the door, clear eyed. He said, "Oh, I feel so good." He said, "What did you do, Bob?" He said, "Well, you know, in the Oxford group, they always say you're supposed to make amends. I never thought a doctor should have to make amends. But I've been making amends all day long, and I just feel wonderful." And that was June 10th, 1935. That was the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because of one major thing. They realized sitting around talking about spirituality is not what had kept Bill sober. It was trying to help people. So they went up to the hospital. Threw a nurse up there, nun. She had a drunken guy that thought he was in there for bad liver and bad a lot of things. And they wanted to talk to him, but they had to talk to his wife first. They said, "We'd like to talk to your husband about his drinking." She's good. She went into her husband and said, "Bill, there are two guys who will want to come and talk to you tomorrow about your drinking." "I don't want to talk to anybody about drinking. Sick of lectures, sick of sermons. Jesus!" He was a lawyer from Louisville who'd moved to Akron to get away from alcohol, and it didn't work, of course. And he said, "I'm not going to talk to anybody." But she was a strong woman. And the next day they came in to see him. And I heard him talk years ago at a meeting, too. One thing nice about being old and sober a long time, I heard a lot of great stuff. And he said, I was laying my head in Akron, and these two men came in to talk to me. And I don't want to hear any more sermons. And they never talked to me about a sermon once. They never even talked about me. They talked about themselves and how they felt and how they felt when they drank and why they drank. I never heard anybody describe me like that before. I couldn't believe my ears. I was so impressed I stayed with those fellows, and I've been with them ever since. And he became number three. Then they tried to work with a few people who didn't stay sober. They got one or two other guys. That went very hard in the Oxford group, because they were all members of the Oxford group. There wasn't any AA. It was just the drinkers part of the Oxford group. And the people in the Oxford group. And finally they got a young guy, 29. Just kind of interesting little thing. And they didn't figure anybody could be an alcoholic that young, but he seemed to be. So they got him involved, and of all things, he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter and did something that many of us have had to pay for many years. He brought our organization its first relationship. I don't know a word that more sends a shiver down sponsors' nose when you hear that. I'm in a new relationship. Oh, Jesus. What you have to have, that is an aha machine, and just put the phone on it and walk away. And your guys say important things like, I know, I thought the last girl was the one, but God, when I saw her working on walking out of detox, I just knew her. Much to everybody's surprise, they got along well and they got married, which is a very touching thing. That happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susan, met a guy I sponsored. They fell in love, much to my chagrin, and they got married. And I want to tell you, that is almost the epitome of mixed emotions. Watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything, but you can give hints. You can say, let me know if he brings a sheep home. And they got married, and so they said, Ernie, you don't have to do all this AA stuff for a while or Oxford group stuff for a while. Why don't you just stay home, get a job, take care of your wife, and we'll take out all this other stuff. And so he said, okay. And so they were shocked when he got drunk and died and turned her against AA for 50 years. But it continued. And pretty soon they got a few people. Then Bill went back to New York, started a little group there, as we all know. They tried to get some money from the Rockefellers, couldn't get any money from the Rockefellers. Bill's wife's brother was a close member of the Rockefeller family, how they got into it. And in 1939, they got a little publicity to magazine, which was didn't do them much good. A magazine called Liberty Magazine, which was kind of a little small magazine. But the writer made it sound like it was a religious cult. And along the same period of time, 1937 to 38, the Oxford group were really getting tired of these drunkards. And they were a very famous thing in the letter of the archives, a letter asking them to please not attend archives. The Oxford group meetings anymore. I know you drink, but it has nothing to do with us. All you ever just talk about drinking. You don't talk about spiritual values. And so they didn't know what to do. And there was a little group broke away. There was a guy in Cleveland, and he used to drive down to Akron to these meetings, and his church, the Catholic Church, really raised hell with him. That is a Protestant organization. You can't go to that. So he couldn't go there anymore. So he started a little group in Cleveland. And he, same thing, but just not run with the Oxford group. And he's the guy who thought of the term Alcoholics Anonymous. Seemed to be a good name. AA didn't. AA had an Alcoholics Anonymous, but they didn't call it that. 1939, this article came out. Anything else that made it look worse. 1940, they're stumbling along. At the end of 1940, they're getting some publicity. And Saturday Evening Post, which was a very big magazine at that time, had a special writer whose job was exposing crooked organizations. He had just written a great series on the rotten labor movement in Philadelphia, how corrupt they were. And his next assignment was, work your way to this Alcoholics Anonymous thing and blow the whistle on them. So he did, and much to his surprise, when he got there, it turned out to be exactly what they said. Nobody was making money. Nobody was doing anything. People were helping people. He couldn't believe it. And he wrote this glowing article we all know about, which appeared in the Saturday Evening Post in 1941. And it just took the nation by storm, because no one had ever heard of a way to help the drunks they were living with. Women called in from all over, wrote in letters. Men wrote in letters, just inundated this P.O. box in New York, because nobody ever heard of them. They were taking the pipe of people that can't stay sober, and they were staying sober. And so they sent out the... They had written a book in 1939. Bill wrote a book. Of course, well, I should have forgot that, but they wrote a book not because they wanted to have a book, but because they thought maybe what we could do is build a big hospital and get all the people sober in there. Then it'll be fine. We'll write this book and we'll sell it and we'll make thousands and thousands of dollars and build a hospital. So Bill wrote this book based on the experience he had, the experience he had with the people around him. And it came out and nobody really bought it. Nobody cared, except a few alcoholics, and they bought theirs, and they sent a mailing to every doctor on the East Coast, and got one answer. Yeah, so thank God they didn't get it. We'd be in the hospital business now if we were alive. But they had this book. What they did in 1941, they sent this book, and a little story about AA, and to each of these places, and told them how to start a little meeting, a little group, and they started groups all over the country. There already was one in California. But they started in a lot of cities, in a lot of places, and just all of a sudden there were thousands of people going to AA meetings all over. And it kind of kept going and crested about 1942, because the war was up. Maybe it has something to do with that, I don't know. 1943, something, it started to erode. They started getting letters saying, you know, we're not holding together. People are fighting all the time, and we can't, people get drunk. In Los Angeles, it's a sad little story. There was 12 people in the AA group. Let me tell you something before that, which is even duller. How AA happened to be in Los Angeles. A woman from New York, her brother got sober in AA in 1939. She brought the manuscript of the book to Los Angeles. The book hadn't been printed, and advertised the paper. Said, "Wives, do you have drunken husbands? There's an answer at last. Call this number." And she got a little, set up a little meeting on a balcony of the Cecil Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. And on this Sunday, 12 women came in with husbands. And they went up in the balcony and she said, okay, here's their book. Go in there and you can have a meeting. They said, well, aren't you coming in? She says, no, I can't come in. I'm not an alcoholic. Well, for Christ's sake, what are we going to do? Well, maybe you could read part of it and talk about it. So these guys sat around a table. There was one guy in there with a shirt and tie on named Morty Josephs. So they said, hey, you in the shirt and tie, you want to read something out of this book and we'll talk about it? All right. He was still around when I got sober. I talked to him a lot of times, very fascinating. And he looked at the table of contents, how it works. That probably has something to do with it. So we read a couple of pages and they talked about it. And the next time they got together, I didn't really get that part. Let's read it again. That's where chapter 5 reading comes from that meeting. But anyway, AA was booming and all of a sudden started to erode and meetings were not going very well. And people, take us off your mailing list. We're no longer here. By the beginning of 1945, Bill was getting desperate because it really was shrinking rapidly. So he thought, how can I unify these people? So he started this little magazine called The Grapevine. Not the way it's in now, used to, like a tabloid. And that helped a little bit, but not much. And by the middle of 1945, AA really seemed to be dying. And a doctor in North Carolina wrote an article for The Grapevine and sent it in and said, Bill, I don't know if you ever saw this before, but there used to be a group just like ours. And Bill read the story about a group he'd never heard of. It turned out that in 1840 in Baltimore, six drunken guys had got together. One was just out of jail. He came back to his friends and said, you know, that chaplain down there said he knew how I felt. He didn't know how I feel. You guys said you guys know how I feel. But we're all dying from drunkenness. What can we do? They decided to all swear off and help one another and talk. And they wrote a little constitution for themselves. They elected officers, five officers, one member. Who do you identify with, folks, you know? And everybody laughed at them. You drunken bastards, you can't even keep yourself sober. You couldn't keep each other. And somehow they stayed sober. Then they got a few more. Then some goofs in Philadelphia heard about it and came down and went back to Philadelphia and started a little group. And by this time, they had to have a name for it. So nobody ever heard of drunkards helping drunkards. One of the first of a kind. So it'd be like America, the first of a kind. So they named it after George Washington, the first president. Became known as the Washingtonians. And they got a little group in New York. And they had a little group in Washington. At the end of the year, they had several hundred people staying sober in much the same manner that AA did later. In the second year, it went to more states, it got other places. By the end of the second year, they had the feeling that we're doing well, but so many people don't understand what we're doing. They think we're goofy or eccentric or something. So they sent a letter to all the chapters they could find and said, on our anniversary, which they used Washington's birthday as their anniversary, on February 22nd, have a local speaker come in, some opinion maker in your city. Now, we don't care what he says. We want him to see that we are just people doing well. So all over the country on February 2nd, 22nd, 1842, they came in Springfield, Illinois, Abraham Lincoln, a young lawyer they thought would mold somebody's opinion. If you look through a book of Lincoln's speeches, you find one to the Washingtonians, 1842. Most of it was just boilerplate, as they did in those days, but in one page it's really touching. He said, I know all of you men, and I've known you in this city, and I understand what you do, and you're wonderful people, but I have never understood your thirst. It baffles me. But whatever it is, I see that you're finding a way to quench it without drinking. And very happy. And it really grew, and it grew. And they got a couple. In those days, the entertainment, there was no TV, no radio. What they had, they'd have mass meetings, and they'd bring in a good speaker, and he'd orate or do something, be funny or serious or whatever. They got a couple of these speakers in the Oxford group, the Washingtonians, and he started talking it up. And pretty soon they had hundreds and thousands of people joining the Oxford group or the Washingtonians all over the country. By 1845, they estimated there were 100,000 members of the Oxford group, which may not seem impressive to you, but AA after 5 years didn't even have 1,000. And in 1845, they're doing very well, and the leaders got together and decided something that sounds strange, but not really strange, because people in AA suggested today. Gee, if we're able to help drunkards, we should be able to help all sorts of people. People who take narcotics, who are not drunkards. People who have other problems. People who have emotional problems. Maybe we should get involved in getting Texas part of the Union. Maybe we should get the anti-slavery movement. All sorts of things. Wonderful moves. And this organization just became involved in so many things. Just great. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct. And with very few exceptions, they all died drunk. I had a book home written by one of the few survivors in 1861. He says, we were doing so well, but we got so involved in so many things, nobody wanted to come to the Washingtonians anymore. They didn't really have time to help drunkards anymore. They were helping so many other people. Just one by one they went. And this was the article that they'd sent to Bill for the grapevine. And Bill read that and thought, my God, that's kind of the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. The inner fighting they had between their speakers and their leaders and the fighting over money and who's going to get the most publicity and all these things. He said, my God, that's... And he sat down and in a fit of absolute desperation and last gasp effort to save AA, he wrote the 12 traditions based on the Washingtonian experience and AA experience. And he wrote them not in the form they're read today, but in the long form in the back of the book across from the short form. There's the long form, which fleshes them out, which everyone should read. We read it in our group once a month so the newcomers know what it's all about. So the 12 traditions are not just something to get someone to read to see if they can pronounce the funny words. Autonomous, huh? And he issued these traditions one by one in the grapevine. And Alcoholics Anonymous at that time had a problem that they have today. There seems to be no solution to it. It's full of alcoholics. And most people didn't want to... We don't want your damn rules! We're here for love, you hear me, goddammit? And a lot of... one by one, he printed them. And a lot of people didn't want them. And they said, you're turning it into some sort of a police state, having rules. So for a couple of years, he and we all know the story, most of us do, pile his wife in a sidecar of his motorcycle, and drive to meetings and explains. And some people went along with it, but a lot of people didn't. By the 1949, they had two very distinct camps. And he felt that this would destroy AA eventually. So he and Dr. Bob always got along very well. Their followers didn't like each other. People in Akron said, oh, those people in New York, bunch of city highbinders. And people in Akron in New York said, oh, those idiots in Akron, those shit kickers, what do they know? And so Bill and Bob assigned their followers to find, let's have one meeting where we get all these elements together and explain it to them. So the people in Akron said, well, we won't go to New York. And the people in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, said, we won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together and said, Cleveland. All right. So in July of 1950, the largest group of sober alcoholics that ever got together in the world outside of the Washingtonian movement, not very many of them, a few hundred, got together in Cleveland, Ohio, and had a little meeting. I got the program. I got the tapes. Interesting. Most of the speakers were not alcoholics because they were so still concerned about public image. They had the warden of San Quentin talk about how about it help his prisoners and things like that. But Bill and Dr. Bob each gave a talk. And Dr. Bob at this time was dying of cancer. They said, you probably don't want to talk, Bill, Bob. So I've got to talk. I've been sober 15 years. That's the second longest sobriety in the world. So on that day, his son on one side and a guy on the other side took this tall, gaunt old man to the podium. And he gave a short talk, which many people conceived to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't start off very well, just started off like this usual crap. He said, I want to welcome you all to Cleveland, and I hope you'll go back and tell the boys and girls in your groups that we all do the same things. We all get out of A, what we put into it. It's all very nice. He said, I do want to apologize for my illness. I've been very ill in bed for much of the last few months. I hope to get better soon. He said, I just feel, as I look over this room today, I'm so happy that some small thing I did years ago helped bring this about. And, it's just all very nice. But they said, but there are two or three things I'd like to call to your attention. And he knew he was dying. Almost like a dying, not a confession, but a dying admonition. He said, there are two or three things I'd like to call to your attention. He said, first, Let us remember to keep our program simple. Let us not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind and nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room who doesn't know exactly what they're talking about. You know, we're all very wonderful when things are going our way. Love is the answer, baby. A-N-I, probably with God. But let somebody hurt our feelings. Didn't call on me in the meeting, you son of a bitch. Doesn't take much. And we have to find a way to overcome those tendencies to react. And finally, he said, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to take us to a few meetings, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it. He said, let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we are too busy to do the same things for the fellow who still suffers. Said, that's about all. He sat down and died shortly thereafter. But that really, that talk is as true. Those three things are just as true today in Portland as they were in 1950 in Akron. In Cleveland. And then after their talk, they had on the tapes six young guys. I guess they're young. They sound young. Each take two traditions and explain what they are. They're not threats. They're just suggestions to save AA. And you could just see their tails wagging. They just start. And remember, we're not establishing a police state. These are not rules. These are not laws. These are suggestions. We don't have any AA police. And a lot of old-timers have taken that phrase and thought, that was a mistake. You know, for example, in my community, although unfairly and unjustly, I am known as something of a dictator-type sponsor. What people forget is you can't be a dictator-type sponsor without the absolute assent of the dictatee. All he has to say is, screw you, and the dictatorship is over. But just think, if we had AA police come at night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp. But they introduced these 12 traditions, and they voted them in. But here's the last thing I'll talk about that. It's amazing, the humanity of it all. I'm sure Bill Wilson was not sure he had a majority in that hall. And at the end of the tradition, he said, we've all heard the traditions read. Seeing no objections, we accept them. That's how they got in. There's no vote on that one. And they did save AA. They really did save AA, and they continue to flourish. One little funny thing about humanity. In 1950, Dr. Bob talked, he was dying, of course. And then from then on, Bill talked on the Friday night meetings. I heard him talk in 1960 at my first international, and 65. And by 1970, it got to be kind of really a cult meeting. We're all in Miami Beach waiting for Bill to talk to 15,000 people in this convention center. Just, you could cut the excitement with a knife. Just, hey, yeah, boy, we're going to... And as the meeting started, a guy came out and said, we're very sorry, but Bill is too sick to speak. We didn't know at the time he was dying of emphysema. He said, he won't be here. And just, oh, the balloon. He said, but we do have someone who'll fill in. Oh, really? Who cares? This poor bastard came out talking to him. You're not Bill. What are you doing here? After the meeting, we were walking back to the hotel to an old guy named John, who got sober under Dr. Bob many years earlier. He'd been sober forever. I said, isn't that too bad, John? We'll never hear Bill Wilson talk again. He said, he'll talk at this convention. I said, no, he won't, Bob. I talked to Bill in New York. He's not going to talk. He said, I just know he'll talk at this convention. I said, well, you're full of crap. Maybe he knew something. I thought, next night, maybe you talked that meeting. He didn't. Sunday morning in the last meeting, the scheduled speaker came on and spoke. There's no Bill Wilson talk. But about halfway through his talk, somebody came up and said, he turned and said, I have some wonderful news. An ambulance has just brought Bill Wilson to the back of this auditorium, and he wants to say a few words. Everybody jumped up and cheered, and the organist played Climb Every Mountain, and here comes Bill. Bill Wilson in his wheelchair with tubes out of him. And, oh, God, it makes me tingle to describe it. And if maybe some of you heard the tape, he said, my dear friends, I want you, he kind of pulled himself, we're doing God's work as long as God wants us to, and we'll continue. Then it sounds as though the tape breaks. But what had happened, he just ran out of air and sat down. And they wheeled him on. Then the guy came back and finished his talk, talking about anticlimax, huh? And on the way back to the hotel, I said to John, I said, John, how in the hell did you know he was going to talk? Nobody knew he was going to talk. He said, kid, remember, you're dealing with human beings. They may be inspired human beings, but they're human beings. Do you think Bill Wilson would want it said that Dr. Bob talked while he was dying and Bill wouldn't? Yeah. And that there's a lot of truth in that, too, in a sense, because we keep putting these people, ennobling them as great, wonderful saviors, and they were fallible human beings fumbling their way forward, and just by great good fortune for us, it all worked out. Because the whole history of Alcoholics Anonymous is seconds and inches. Coming to the Oxford group, or Ebby, him thinking out of no place, Bill Wilson. Why do you think of Bill? Why not just take somebody to the next street? And having go up to the hospital and put something in his mind that helped stimulate the spiritual awakening. And the continuing to keep going when he wanted to quit. And having that experience in Akron where he's going to walk away, I've done my best, and try one more phone call, which saved our life. And after Dr. Bob got drunk again, and then knowing that we could do something about this, we'll talk to Bill in the hospital. And little by little, all the things, the money that they tried to get the Oxford group, I mean, from the Rockefellers, would have ruined this organization. They'd have been fighting over money, property, and prestige. They didn't have much emotional maturity at that time. And writing a book, which is a miracle. That book is a miracle. I just talked just a couple of minutes about it. It's a miracle because the man who wrote it didn't know enough to write it. And he wrote a book that's inspired, has to be inspired by some force beyond him. Because that book has done something, it has changed more alcoholics' lives of our type in the last 60-odd years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That's kind of a miracle. Miracle is kind of a cheap word they throw around a lot. I think I mentioned it last year. My idea turned me off on miracle a few years ago. Sitting in a meeting, some old fool was up there talking, said, I had a miracle. I got up early this morning and I looked at the eastern sky and the sun was rising, and I said, it's a miracle. I have another wonderful day of sobriety. Oh, Jesus. Get up early tomorrow and have another one, you old fool. You know, miracles are supposed to be non-explainable, or inexplicable, as the word is. And nobody could really understand how this book did so well. It's a funny thing. I was talking to a friend earlier about how, I don't know if it's out of boredom or what it is now, but there are little groups that get together and just study the book. Just memorize the book and study the book. They don't have time for much helping anybody, but they got the book. And it's kind of hard to realize the book is not designed for that. The book is a series of emotional recipes that you surrounded by data and narrative, of course, but they tell you how to do things. And you can read the whole book and memorize it and still get drunk. Just like you can memorize a cookbook. If you don't cook it, you're going to starve. How could I be starving? I know all the recipes, goddammit, you know. And the book is designed to have us, stimulate us to do things that none of us are going to ever do them very well. We like to think we do. Sometimes people who are out speaking are carried away with their magnificence, and you get the feeling there's somebody behind them carving their words in marble. But we're all fallible human beings, and some of us have been sober longer than others, and some we've got to learn more lessons, that's all. And the book is a great aid, but the book is still, nevertheless, the book is designed as an emotional cookbook, I believe. And I would much rather see someone that I know and love bring a new person to a meeting than be able to recite chapter 5 without reading. You know, it's not even close. Because we are here in the last analysis, we try to help somebody else. And we return to some power greater than ourselves, which I'll talk about tonight, I guess. But the great fact of it all is that it's just kind of fun. I told you a lot of stuff you already know, some of it maybe you didn't know today. But the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous is that so many things fell in place just right. A day later, too late. Abby would have gone to penitentiary. Everybody, on and on. Just so many things. And here we are, feeling good and taking it for granted and working to remember to be grateful that we are very fortunate. And that's the end of my talk.